and welcome to Albion Narrations. You're listening to me, Sven Longshanks, streaming at radioalbion.com. Today's narration is part three of Victories of Revisionism, a letter from Professor Robert Faurisson to President Mahmoud Ahmadinejad. Number 17. In 1996, the left-wing French historian Jacques Beynac, a staunch anti-revisionist since 1978, ended up admitting after due consideration that there was no evidence of the Nazi gas chamber's existence. One could not fail to note, wrote Beynac, the absence of documents, traces, or other material evidence. But he did say that he carried on believing in the existence of those magical gas chambers. All in all, J. Beynac says, there is no evidence, but I believe. Whereas a revisionist thinks, there is no evidence, therefore I refuse to believe, and it is my duty to dispute. Number 18. In 2000, at the end of her book, Histoire du Negationism en France, Valérie Aiguinet published a long text by Jean-Claude Prissac, at the end of which the latter, who had been one of the revisionists' most determined opponents, signed a veritable act of surrender. In effect, taking up the words of Professor Michel Debouar, he stated that the dossier on the concentration camp system was rotten, and irredeemably so. He wrote, asking, can things be put back on an even keel? And answered, it is too late. He added, the current form, albeit triumphant, of the presentation of the camp universe is doomed. He finished by surmising that everything that had been invented around sufferings all too real was bound for the rubbish bins of history. In 1993 to 1994, that protégé of the French Jew Sergei Klarsfeld and the American rabbi Michael Berenbaum, project director at the Holocaust Memorial Museum in Washington, had been acclaimed worldwide as an extraordinary researcher in his book on Le Crématoire d'Auschwitz, English title The Auschwitz Crematories, The Machinery of Mass Murder, had, it appeared, felled the hydra of revisionism. Here, in V. Aiguinet's book, he was seen signing his act of surrender. The greater public are kept in ignorance of a major fact. The man who had supposedly saved the day for history, who once was presented by the world press as an extraordinary researcher who had at last discovered the scientific proof of the Nazi gas chamber's existence, ended up acknowledging his error. A few years later, not a single newspaper or magazine announced his death. Number 19. In 2002, R.J. Van Pelt, already mentioned, published The Case for Auschwitz, Evidence from the Irving Trial. As is widely known, David Irving, who at the very most is a semi-revisionist, ill acquainted with the revisionist argumentation, lost the libel suit he had recklessly brought against the Jewish-American academic Deborah Lipstadt. He tried clumsily to make the case, a perfectly right one for that matter, that there had existed no homicidal gas chambers at Auschwitz, but he nonetheless scored an essential point, and if Justice Charles Gray and other judges after him had had more courage, that point would have enabled him to succeed in his claim. The argument was summed up in a four-word phrase that I first put forth in 1994. No holes, no Holocaust. My reasoning behind it was as follows. Number one, Auschwitz is at the centre of the Holocaust. Number two, the great crematoria of Auschwitz-Birkenau or Auschwitz II are at the centre of the vast Auschwitz complex. Number three, at the heart of these crematoria, there were, supposedly, one or several homicidal gas chambers. Number four, at a single one of these crematoria, crematorium number two, although it is in ruins, it is today possible to go and examine the room said to have been a gas chamber. It is the presumed scene of the crime, itself presumed as well. Number five, We are told that in order to kill the Jewish detainees locked inside, an SS man moved about on the concrete roof of the said gas chamber, poured Zyklon B pellets through four regular openings situated in the roof. Number 6. However, one need only have eyes to realise that no such openings have ever existed there. Number 7. Therefore, the crime cannot have been committed. For R.J. Van Pelt testifying against Irving, it was near torture trying to find a reply to this argument. Justice Gray as well had to acknowledge the apparent absence of evidence of holes, and in a more general way he conceded that contemporaneous documents yield little clear evidence of the existence of gas chambers designed to kill humans. In the text of his judgment, Charles Gray admitted surprise. I have to confess that in common, I suspect, with most other people, I had supposed that the evidence of mass extermination of Jews in the gas chambers at Auschwitz was compelling. I have, however, set aside this preconception when assessing the evidence adduced by the parties in these proceedings. Here, the failure of the accusing historians is flagrant, and Irving ought to have won his case, thanks to that observation by a judge who was hostile towards him. The documents of the era furnish us with but decidedly clear evidence of the Nazi gas chamber's existence, and thus of a German policy to exterminate the Jews. Is this not, after all, as we have seen above, what several Jewish historians had already concluded, beginning with Leon Polyakov in 1951? Number 20. In 2004, French historian Florent Braillard published a work entitled La solution finale de la question juive. In a review of this book, the following three sentences could be read. It is known that the Führer neither drafted nor signed any order to eliminate the Jews. That the decisions, for there were several, were taken in the secrecy of talks with Himmler, perhaps Heydrich and or Göring. It is supposed that, rather than an explicit order, Hitler gave his consent to his interlocutors' requests or projects. Perhaps he did not even put it into words, but made himself understood by a silence or an acquiescence. At nearly every word, these sentences show that their author is reduced to adventurous speculations. When he dares to express, without the benefit of the least clue, the notion that Hitler perhaps made himself understood by a silence or an acquiescence, he is merely taking up the theory of the nod, the Führer's mere nod, first voiced by American professor Christopher Browning at the Zundel trial in Toronto in 1988. No academic of anti-revisionist persuasion has shown himself to be more pitiful and foolish than that Shabbos Goy. So true is it that, destroyed by the revisionist victories, the official case has ended up being emptied of all scientific content. Let us briefly recapitulate these revisionist victories. Their backs are set to the wall by the revisionists. The official historians of the alleged physical extermination of the Jews have ended up acknowledging that, from the historical and scientific viewpoint, they are left without a single argument to support their ghastly accusation. They admit, in effect, that number one, they cannot invoke a single document proving the crime. Number two, that they are unable to provide the least representation of the crime weapon. Number three, that they do not possess any proof nor even any evidence. Number four, that they cannot name a single truthful witness. See above S. Vale's opinion on that matter. Number five, that their dossier is rotten, which has been twice repeated, irredeemably rotten, and that it is bound for the rubbish bins of history. Number six, that the sources formerly invoked have revealed themselves to be not only rarer than was claimed, but also unreliable. Number seven, that the alleged traces of the crime are few and far between and difficult to interpret. Number eight, that at their end there have been falsifications, misrepresentation and artifice. Number 9, that in support of their case, there has too often been invoked a silly sick story, that of a decision to exterminate the Jews, supposedly taken on January 20th, 1942 at Berlin Wannsee. Number 10, that the foremost of their number, Raoul Hilberg, is today reduced to explaining it all in a nonsensical way by supposed initiatives that the German bureaucracy had, according to him, boldly taken without any order, plan, instruction or supervision, and thanks simply, it seems, to an incredible meeting of minds and a consensus mind-reading. These official historians have not known how to answer any of the revisionists' requests or observations in the style of 1. Show me or draw me a Nazi gas chamber. 2. Bring me one proof, one single piece of evidence of your own choosing on the grounds of which to assert that there was a genocide. Number 3. Bring me one testimony, one single testimony, the best one in your opinion. Or again, number 4, no holes, no Holocaust. Finding themselves on the ropes, the court historians have called on the law courts to find against the revisionists. But contrary to all expectation, it has sometimes happened that the judges have gone so far as to pay tribute to the revisionists' uprightness or to show their surprise before the sparseness or absence of the accuser's documentary evidence. Then, first in France, and later in a number of other countries in Europe, these accusers have called for the passing of special laws to silence the revisionists. Here, they have sealed their doom. To resort to special laws, to the police and prisons, is to admit one's utter inability to use the arguments of reason, history, and science. 100 other arguments again could be recalled here to prove that on the plane of history and science, the immense edifice of lies put up by the Holocaust or Shoah sect has been thrown down with not one stone left upon another. In contrast to this expanse of ruins, we have seen the construction of a whole revisionist literature. In it can be discovered a profusion of documents, photographs, expert studies, trial transcripts, technical and scientific reports, testimonies, statistical studies, all of which bearing on 100 aspects of the history of the Second World War that show what the lot of the European Jews was in reality, and demonstrate in striking manner that the Jewish version of that war is largely of the order of myth. From the myth, the Jews have gone on to mythology, and from mythology on to religion, or rather to a semblance of religion. Today, the servants of that false religion appear more and more like priests who carry on officiating and turning over the hallowed phrases, but manifestly no longer have the faith. They seem no longer really to believe in their credo. So it is, for instance, that for about the last 10 years they have been seen advising their flocks to observe the greatest possible discretion on the subject of the gas chambers. In his memoirs, published in French in 1994 and in English in 1995, the big false witness Eli Wiesel wrote, "Let the gas chambers remain closed to prying eyes and to imagination." Claude Lanzmann, the maker of the film Shoah, Daniel Goldhagen, author of Hitler's Willing Executioners, Simone Veil, former president of the European Parliament, quoted above, François Lyotard, a former French government minister, have in the last few months become surprisingly reserved, cautious or silent on the matter. Some months ago, Jacques Attali, a Jewish businessman and historian, decreed, "The immense majority of Jews murdered were killed by German soldiers and a military policeman's individual weapons between 1940 and 1942, and not by the death works which were put into place afterwards." This implicit way of writing off the alleged Nazi gas chambers is becoming regular practice. Attempts are made to replace the Auschwitz lie with the lie of Baba Yar, or those of other fantastical slaughters in the Ukraine or the Baltic countries, But not once are we provided with scientific evidence concerning them, such as reports of exhumation and postmortems, as has been the case with the real massacres perpetrated by the Soviets at Kitchen, Vinnytsia, or elsewhere. As for the number of dead at Auschwitz, we are hardly told any longer that it was 9 million, as in the film Nuit et Brouillard, Night and Fog, 8 million, 6 million, or 4 million, as at the Nuremberg trial or on the commemorative stones at Auschwitz-Birkenau until 1990. The new religion's clerics are settling for 1.5 million, as marked on those same stones since 1995, or for 1,100,000, or for 700,000, as J.C. Pressack wrote, or still for 510,000, as Frisjof Meyer concluded in 2002. All these latter figures being no better founded than the previous ones. We are granted the privilege of witnessing, in this beginning of the 21st century, a serious calling into question of one of the greatest lies in history. The myth of the Holocaust may well be aglow with 1,000 lights. In reality, it is burning itself out. It has served to justify the creation in the land of Palestine of a warlike colony that has taken the name of Jewish state and endowed itself with a Jewish army. It imposes on the Western world the yoke of a Jewish or Zionist tyranny, bringing itself to bear in all fields of intellectual, academic, and media activity. It poisons the very soul of a great country, Germany. It has allowed the extortion from the latter, as well as from a good number of other Western countries, of exorbitant sums in marks, in dollars, or in euros. It overwhelms us with films, with museums, with books that keep the flame of a Talmudic-style hatred burning. It makes it possible to call for an armed crusade against the axis of evil, and for this to fabricate on demand the most shameless lies precisely in the pattern of the great lie of the Holocaust. For there is no difference between Adolf Hitler's weapons of mass destruction and those of Saddam Hussein's. It makes it possible to accuse nearly the whole world, and to demand repentance and reparations everywhere, either for alleged actions directed against Yahweh's chosen people, an alleged complicity in the crime, or an alleged general indifference to the fate of the Jews during the Second World War. Under its belt, it has a glut of rigged trials, beginning with the loathsome Nuremberg trial. It has sanctioned thousands of hangings of defeated soldiers, an atrocious post-war purge, the deportation of millions of civilians chased from their ancestral homelands, indescribable pillaging, tens of thousands of scandalous legal proceedings, including those carried out today against octogenarians or nonagenarians attacked by miraculous Jewish survivors giving their false testimony. These abominations, this outrage of lies and hatred, this hubris that one day or another destiny always comes to punish, in short, all these excesses must end. No nation has shown more patience with this Jewish or Zionist hubris than the Arab nation. However, we see that this nation itself has now run out of patience. It is going to throw off the Israeli yoke and have the West understand that the time has come to seek real peace, instead of supporting and arming an artificial state that maintains itself only by force. Even in the West, even in the United States, the scales are falling off some people's eyes, and there is now a certain awareness of the hazards imposed on the international community by such prolonged submission to the false religion of the Holocaust. Number one weapon, sword and shield of the State of Israel. There exist some practical means to launch a real action against this false religion, with its sanctuary located at Auschwitz. As is known, in the heart of Auschwitz there is an emblematic gas chamber. Up to now, 30 million tourists have visited it. It is an imposture. All the historians are aware of this, as the authorities of the Auschwitz State Museum know better than anyone. Yet, UNESCO, on October 26, 1969, at the request of the Polish government, put this camp on its list of World Heritage and Cultural Property Sites, thus assuming the duty of preserving its authenticity. For my part, I suggest, therefore, that the matter of this fraud be formally referred to UNESCO, as it constitutes an offence against education, science and culture. In a more general manner, we could take up the words of Jean-Gabriel Cohen-Bendit in 1979. Let us fight for the destruction of those gas chambers they show tourists in the camps where there were none, as we now know. There exist other practical means to fight the tyranny of the Holocaust myth, first amongst which is to announce to the whole world these revisionist victories, which have thus far been kept hidden from it. I trust the revisionists present at this gathering will suggest other means and discuss them with us. Practicing mendacity on a grand scale, the Holocaust religionists have made themselves, little by little, the enemies of the human race. For more than 60 years, they have progressively been putting the whole world, or just about, under indictment. Their main target has, of course, been Germany, and all those who, alongside that country, had thought it their duty to fight against Stalin in the same way that others, in the opposing camp, believed they must fight against Hitler. But in their accusatory frenzy, Jewish organisations have gone so far as to rebuke the wartime allies for an alleged criminal indifference to the lot of the European Jews. They have attacked Roosevelt, Churchill, de Gaulle, Pope Pius XII, the International Committee of the Red Cross, and numerous other personalities, official bodies or countries for not having denounced the existence of the gas chambers. But how could what was so obviously just a grotesque war rumour have been considered verified? It is enough to read the book by the Jew Walter Lacker, The Terrible Secret, to gather 30 or so references to the widespread and thoroughly justified scepticism in the Allied camp before the flood of rumours originating from Jewish sources. Inquiries were carried out, enabling officials to conclude that the rumours were unfounded. It was thus clear-sightedness and not indifference that the Allies and others charged showed. It was that same clear-sightedness which, after the war, in their speeches or in their memoirs, Churchill, de Gaulle and Eisenhower showed as they avoided mentioning even so much as once the said gas chambers. War and war propaganda need lies, just as crusades and the crusader spirit are fueled by hatred. On the other side, peace and friendship between peoples can only gain from care being taken to achieve exactitude in historical research, research that all must be able to carry out in complete freedom. And we will finish up with two appendices concerning the alleged gas chambers of Auschwitz I, and the first one is Eric Conan's 1995 statement in its entirety. And he says, "Another delicate subject, what to do about the falsifications bequeathed by the communist administration. In the 50s and 60s, several buildings which had either disappeared or been put to other use were reconstructed, with serious errors, and presented as genuine. Some, too, new, were closed to the public, to say nothing of the delousing chambers that were at times presented as execution gas chambers. These aberrations have been of great service to the negationists, who have drawn on them for the main substance of their fabrications. The example of Crematorium 1, the lone one at Auschwitz 1, is significant. In its morgue was installed the first gas chamber. It functioned for a short time in early 1942. The isolation of the zone, called for by the gassings, disrupted the camp's activity. It was therefore decided towards the end of April 1942 to transfer these lethal gassings to Birkenau, where they were carried out on essentially Jewish victims on an industrial scale. Crematorium 1 was subsequently turned into an air raid shelter with an operating room. In 1948, during the museum's creation, Crematorium 1 was reconstituted in its supposed original state. Everything in it is false." the gas chamber's dimensions, the location of the doors, the openings for the pouring in of the Zyklon B, the ovens, rebuilt according to what the survivors remembered, and the height of the chimney. In the late 1970s, Robert Faurisson exploited these falsifications all the better, as the museum administration balked at acknowledging them. An American negationist has recently shot a video inside the gas chamber, still being presented as authentic. In it, he can be seen addressing his revelations to the visitors. Jean-Claude Prissac, one of the first to establish exactly the history of this gas chamber and its modifications during and after the war, proposes that it be restored to its 1942 state, basing his suggestion on the German blueprints that he has recently found in the Soviet archives. Others, like Theo Klein, prefer to leave it in its present state whilst explaining the misrepresentation to the public. History is what it is. It suffices to tell it, even when it is not simple, rather than to add artifice to artifice. Christina Oleksy, whose director's office, which occupies the old SS hospital, looks straight out onto Crematorium 1, and she has not resigned herself to do so. For the time being, it is to be left as is, with nothing specified to the visitor. It is too complicated. We will see to it later on. In his lengthy study, E. Conan wanted to show the great distance between remembrance and history. He did so without calling into question the dogma of the Holocaust. He even went so far as to state his belief in the existence of the weapon of mass destruction, called gas chamber, and he posited certain assertions, devoid of the least scientific foundation, as being exact and demonstrated. Nonetheless, he had the courage to denounce some serious lies, amongst which that of the emblematic gas chamber presented today to visitors at Auschwitz. And he dares to admit that in the late 1970s, I was right about the matter. In 2005, I asked him whether his study had given rise to any rectifications or protests, particularly on the part of the Auschwitz State Museum authorities and Christina Oleksy, and his answer was none. Number 2, the full relevant passage in a CD-ROM booklet prefaced by Simone Veil. Robert Faurisson has the motivation, exclusive love of the truth. This would seem to be an obsession of his. An academic, Robert Faurisson, was never to cease using this scientific surety, a presumed pledge of respectability. He read Maurice Bardèche, he discovered Paul Racinière, he dissected Rimbaud, Lutremont and Apollinaire. A brilliant and cultured man, he is nonetheless one bent on causing trouble. Through the 70s, Robert Faurisson worked. He outlined his historical literary method. He went to the Auschwitz archives. His denial was to build itself there. And it rests on a real fact. The gas chamber at the Auschwitz I camp is a reconstitution, for it served as a storehouse for SS medical supplies and as an air raid shelter after the gas chambers at Auschwitz II Birkenau were put into service. What he was able to see, and what can still be seen, is a supposed gas chamber. This is undeniable. Be that as it may, for Robert Faurisson, it is a put-up job done by the Jews. And finally, we have Professor Bruno Gollnisch had merely stated that on the subject of the gas chambers, historians ought to be able to express themselves freely. He was first suspended from teaching for 5 years by the University of Lyon III. Then, on November 7th and 8th, 2006, he had to appear before a court in Lyon made up of presiding judge Fernand Scheer and two associates. Pressures and blackmail led him to break down and acknowledge before his judges the existence of the genocide of the Jews and the Nazi gas chambers. The court's decision will be pronounced on January 18th, 2007. It must be realised that French law prohibits any disputing of the reality of Nazi crimes against the Jews, even if such disputing is presented in veiled or dubitative form or by way of insinuation. Consequently, with regards to this matter, one must neither dispute nor even appear to dispute. Thank you very much for listening, and watch out for more Albion narrations in the future.